and current state for Tuesday, April 8th. Joe Lindstroth in for Mark Bayshore, who's out again today. Congratulations to the University of Connecticut men's basketball team. They defeated Kentucky last night 60-54. The UConn women play tonight for the women's championship against Notre Dame. That could be a raucous celebration of sportsmanship there in Storrs, Connecticut later this week. I don't know about you. As soon as the Michigan teams left, it was kind of ABC for me. Anyone but Calipari. If you're a basketball fan, I think you might know what I mean. Also, a reminder, today is Equal Pay Day. It's the day in which they recognize that it's the amount in which a woman would have to work to equal the pay of a man in 1 year's salary. 23% gender wage gap. Today, Equal Pay Day, April 8th. We have a great show for you coming up today. We're going to look at the winter impact on certain Michigan fruit crops and how they managed to survive this brutal winter here in Michigan, along with the rest of us. We'll also look at a new locally grown food initiative that seeks to bring more locally grown food onto the tables and the trays of hospitals, school districts, school cafeterias, etc. But first, in case you've happened to miss it, the U.S. Supreme Court last week came out with another controversial ruling on our nation's campaign finance laws. In the case McCutcheon versus the FEC, the Supreme Court, in its usual 5-4 split across ideological lines, struck down the limits on the overall amount of money an individual can give to all federal candidates and committees in a 2-year election cycle. The decision effectively raises the individual donation limit to approximately $3.5 million from what was about $117,000. Reactions to this decision, of course, have been polarized, from supporters claiming a First Amendment victory for freedom of speech to detractors claiming the sky is starting to crumble on our democracy. With me now to help sort out what this means for our political climate and for upcoming Michigan races is Rich Robinson. He's the executive director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. Welcome back, Rich.
Thanks, Joe. Good to be here.
And also with me is Richard McClellan, a Lansing attorney, experienced in campaign finance and a longtime state GOP power broker. Welcome back, Richard.
Thank you, Joe. Happy to be here.
First, Rich, just if you will, elaborate a little bit more on just what the justices were looking at in this case.
Well, the argument for having an aggregate limit was essentially to preclude the possibility of shuffling money from committee to committee, circumventing individual contribution limits. That's the bedrock of the argument for the aggregate limits. I think there's also an element of how much can you allow an individual to own of the political process. That really didn't come up into the arguments. But to put this in context, the number of people in the United States who bumped into that limit last election cycle was 591 persons who gave the maximum amount to federal candidates. So that's one out of every 500,000 Americans was having their freedoms infringed upon by this aggregate contribution limit.
Richard, is that your understanding of what the justices were looking at in this case? Do you agree with what Rich was saying there? Anything you'd like to add?
No, I think that I think he properly sets out his side of the argument. And I think that from my perspective, the most telling thing that Rich just said and reflects that broader view is whether rich people should be allowed, he used the term allowed, and the difference between those who want to regulate who political speech and people like myself don't think the question is who should be allowed to speak at what levels and with what amount of money, but whether the government has any good reason to limit such activity or to target any individual or group to restrict their liberty. So frequently this kind of conversation, Rich and I sort of talk past each other. He articulates his policy perspective, and I'll probably articulate mine. And this is what the Supreme Court wrestled with in the McCutcheon case, as they have done really for 40 years, I guess.
And when they're looking at restricting liberty, I mean, they're looking at particularly the definition of corruption, or what would equal corruption. Is that correct, Rich?
That's exactly the point of all of this. And what Chief Justice Roberts said in his opinion is, even though sometimes it gets a little gray about the difference between quid pro quo corruption and dependence corruption, the Supreme Court can only rule on quid pro quo corruption. So, you know, I think what he's effectively done is define political corruption out of existence going forward.
Richard, would you agree with that assessment?
No, I wouldn't, but I would agree that the cases are always dance around this issue of quid pro quo corruption, because that's the only basis that the Supreme Court has ever found to limit political speech. The real underlying effort, however, is to limit the political speech of certain people. So the whole point of the First Amendment is to protect individual speech. This is what Justice Roberts said, that the majority might prefer to restrict, or that legislators or judges might not view as useful to the democratic process. So you have this effort to stop, quote, rich people from speaking in the political sense as much as they want. And we've had it other times in history. We try to shut down other groups of people. Here on Michigan State University, 50 years ago, they tried to keep communists off campus from speaking. I was involved in that. So these battles go on and on. But the question is, can the government, under the First Amendment, restrict who can speak? And then you go to the reason. The only reason you could is this corruption idea. I think that that's not the issue. It's really designed to influence, to enhance the relative influence of others if you can shut certain people down.
Well, I think one of the things we're talking about here, Rich, when I hear a speech is money here in this conversation. Is that correct, Rich? Is there a problem that you have with that, that the court seems to be equating speech and money?
Well, absolutely. Speech is an endorsement. Freedom of association is standing up in endorsement of a candidate. Money is property, and the exchange of money is an investment that seeks and usually gets a return on investment. And, you know, the fundamental problem here is that this was a barrier against circumvention of individual contribution limits. Justice Breyer laid it out in tables in the dissent, in the opinion. And Chief Justice Roberts dismissed it as divorced from reality. In my experience at looking how money sloshes around from committee to committee to committee, this is not divorced from reality. This is a fundamental part of American politics.
You know, I think that a lot of times this conversation gets split between conservative and liberal and right and left and that kind of thing. But I think most polls I saw, 75 to 80% of the American public, regardless of political affiliation, would like to see less money in politics and think there's too much money in politics. Richard, you know, why should the average voter or the average small business or nonprofit that wants to participate in the political process but doesn't have the thousands of dollars or even the tens of thousands of dollars be happy with this ruling?
Well, only because they understand and support the U.S. Constitution. The First Amendment says Congress shall make no law restricting freedom of speech. The courts have said pretty clearly money does equal speech. And I think that that is a fundamental finding that they've made, that under our system, to have speech, you have to spend money. Other people argue that it's really democracy versus property interests. That's what the Voices of Russia website said I looked at this morning. But other people say that, as Rich says, he articulates very well their view. My view is much more pure free speech, political speech being the most important. And even if you don't like the people that are speaking, you can't limit them. You can't limit the amount of speech. You can't limit the amount of money they spend. And And because if you're doing so, you are doing so to advance some other interest that you're not limiting.
My name is Joe Lindstroth. I'm in for a current state host, Mark Bayshore. I'm speaking with Rich Robinson, the executive director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, and Richard McClellan, a longtime Lansing attorney, about McCutchen versus FEC, the Supreme Court ruling last week. Richard, I think that brings up another point on the other side of the First Amendment coin or conversation here. Is it, what about the right to be heard as well as the right to speak? You know, by protecting such this minute, wealthy portion of the electorate and their right for free speech, are we in turn, you know, conversely drowning out a larger majority of the electorate's voices who can't be heard because of a lack of money? Is there a balance there that
might
push?
That is what the people that are arguing. They have other people that they think should have more speech. I always think one of the things Justice Roberts says was, it's like limiting the number of candidates a newspaper can support. Well, what if they said the Free Press, Detroit Free Press, could only endorse 15 candidates? So they do want to limit so that other people can have their voices heard. Now, those other voices, the truth is there's almost no organized economic interest in our society that doesn't have their supporters and the money. I mean, to say that there is a lack of funding for these various voices, you just have to have been around 40 years and seen the power the unions used to have, the some of the liberal groups, George Soros, the Republicans used to beat up on George Soros in the same way that the Democrats beat up on the Koch brothers now. There is plenty of money. Now, does that mean the individual citizen out there has a limited voice? Yes, he or she does. The one thing to remember is, don't forget, this Michigan has no aggregate limits. This McCutchen case had no impact on state elections. We've never had any limits. So these super wealthy, if they want to buy the Michigan legislature, can do so. And so we seem to be surviving. So no, I don't think that's a valid point that the Constitution doesn't permit it. It just means that if somebody else is going to talk louder, you're going to have to work harder to organize and get your voice out.
Rich, what do you make of that point? Is that a valid argument that protecting this small minority might in turn disenfranchise a larger portion of our electorate?
Well, let's set that aside. I'd like to step back to the clarity of the idea that money is speech. Now, since Justice O'Connor left the bench, yes, the majority, and in this case the plurality with Justice Thomas, have been able to prevail on this idea. Money is just not speech. You know, and the idea in this case that the court could reverse an act of Congress based on a 5-4 majority, that's not clarity, and that's liable to be reversed with the next new appointment on the court. You know, Justice Breyer said in his dissent, if you're doing this, shouldn't you have a record? And he included in his dissent a lot of the record of members of Congress who are familiar with politics talking about what it is that money, how money corrupts the process. It was clear to members of Congress, you have a Supreme Court now, since Justice O'Connor left the court, where no one's ever run for public office at all. No one has experience with what the meaning of money in the political process is. Only two of them that I can find have even made a campaign contribution because they've been sequestered on the federal bench up to this point. So money does corrupt the political process. It has been given a freer path. You know, let me give just one example of how this can work. One could make contributions to every leadership PAC of members of Congress. Now, leadership PACs can be converted to personal use. You know, maybe the House Ethics and Senate Ethics preclude that, but that's only for active members. Once you're out, you can cash that in and use it for personal purposes. That's corrupting. And if there are no limits on how much of that an individual or a group of individuals can do, there is going to be a great deal more corruption. Public policy will be bent to the whims of the money.
Richard, what do you make of that? I mean, the court seems to be kind of restricted to this quid pro quo definition of corruption, and you have politicians who I think would readily admit there's a gray area that doesn't fall within that definition. And I think that's what you're getting at, Rich, is that, you know, some of the campaign finance laws were designed by politicians because they know their climate and know kind of a threshold at which 117,000 sounds rather arbitrary, but that measure might be where they draw the line in terms of anything more is corrupting in some fashion. What do you make of that gray area? How does that fall within what we're talking
about?
Well,
what I say is that gray area is exactly where we're going to be fighting, because the question is this concept of appearance of quid pro quo corruption, it's not really corruption, but it sort of looks like it, is that sufficient reason to limit First Amendment political speech? And I argue it doesn't. On the other hand, I absolutely agree with Rich. Money alone can be corrupting, particularly direct contributions to candidates can be corrupting. Now, he has to, by eliminating the aggregate limits in McCutcheon, he then has to come up with some imaginary horribles about giving to multiple committees and moving the money around, and that could happen. But at the end of the day, it's the idea that what's more important, the political rights of people to speak in our system, democratic system. Right now, the majority of people in this state and the majority of powers would rather limit it. They don't like the First Amendment. In fact, many people want to limit the thing. Money is speech in some sense in our society. If you're going to buy a television ad, if you're going to actually speak other than on a street corner, it does take money. And this is the finding of the court. I'm not making this up. Rich would like to turn that back, and I think that would be a significant opening to then really erode the First Amendment in the same way he is worked up about McCutcheon. I would be very worked up about any rolling back of the idea that money is speech.
Well, I think it is fair to say, though, that the justices in the past have limited speech under the First Amendment. I mean, First Amendment is not a blanket. You know, and we're not just talking about the yelling rat or fire in a crowded movie theater. They have, in occasion, limited speech in the past. Correct, Rich?
Well, yes. Justice Stevens went to great length in Citizens United discussing the various ways that speech can be limited. But, you know, these are not imaginary horribles. People like Warren Rudman, Alan Simpson, Christopher Shays, testified convincingly to the court about the nature of how money corrupts the political process. It's not imaginary to those who are involved in the process.
Richard, does this have a potential, or either of you really, does this have a potential, and I think, fair or not, we're looking at now this, at least in the short term, seems to benefit the GOP. I think that's where everyone's going. I mean, I think long term it could benefit all political parties. But short term, if we just take that for granted, does this have a potential, at least short term, to backfire for the GOP to as they're trying to wrest away the image of them being a party for the wealthy or for corporations and kind of... You know, does the GOP have an image problem to worry about here with this?
The problem, that isn't the problem, but certainly it has backfired.
Uh-huh.
The last election, we had several of these really totally unqualified lunatic candidates that would get some millionaire to support them, and Republicans would control the U.S. Senate other than the fact that large amounts of money can come in and support a candidate. So there's some downsides to it for the Republicans. Republicans have an uncanny ability to shoot themselves in the foot a lot of times by they're taking all this money that they have and coming up with policy prescriptions that simply are out of tune with where the public is. And we've seen that probably in the social issues recently. So, but if you tell me overall, sure, Republicans have more rich people. The Democrats have lots of rich people who are willing to spend a lot of money. So it's a lot more even than they thought. I mean, Obama raised $1 billion last election. Now, he raised it through a very sophisticated system, but a lot of Wall Street money went behind him. So I think at the end of the day, anytime there's an advantage for one, the next election round, the other side figures out how to undermine that. And like I say, Republicans have an ability to shoot themselves in the foot no matter how much money they have.
Well, I think the point that you bring up there, I think, is a point for maybe both parties need to take into consideration is that, you know, with this kind of with this ruling, it has a potential for parties to risk becoming even more out of touch, I think, with what the American public wants by listening to only this select class of donors that have more of a voice. Rich?
Certainly Democrats can be corrupted as well.
Of
the
course.
Whole treatment of Wall Street is reflective of that. As far as where this is going, though, this is part of a step-by-step process. The next thing we're going to see is the reversal of the prohibition against direct corporate contributions to candidates.
Well, Clarence Thomas kind of hinted that in his concurring.
Well, he's way off, but Jim Bopp has applied for cert for an Iowa right to life case where in the state of Iowa, unions can make contributions directly to candidates, corporations cannot. That will be the vehicle to undo the prohibition against direct corporate contributions to candidates. I see that Senator McConnell has accumulated a number of overage contributions, and I expect he's positioning himself to be the plaintiff to argue the case that we just need to liberate money a little bit more and just eliminate contribution limits altogether. So this is a process. This seems to be Chief Justice Roberts' life cause on the court. You know, Chief Justice Warren wanted to desegregate the South. Chief Justice Roberts sees himself as the servant of the American Church of the Almighty Dollar.
I would say that Rich's exact, until he went off on Justice Roberts, he's exactly right that this is an organized effort. And Mr. Bopp, who's bringing a number of these cases, I've been involved in this whole effort for over 25 years. And that is step by step to take the cases before the court and to expand political speech and expand the use of money in our system. So in that sense, he's exactly right. These battles, like civil rights, like other rights, they go on for decades in the court as you fight over these fundamental issues. And this battle is not going away. It is true there could be some setbacks if the makeup of the court 5-4, it could be 4-5, and all of a sudden repeal Citizens United, and so these fights will go on and on and on forever. They've been going on for 200 years.
And Richard, you touched on it, and I want to bring it back here to Michigan. You know, what, if any, effect would this ruling have on the – we have all kinds of races coming up here in November. What, if any, effect might this have at all now? Can you see anything at all, Richard?
We have a very important U.S. Senate race.
Correct.
We have a number of congressional vacancies now, a couple of them anyway, and you could potentially see – these changes. When these changes occur, why, it takes a few months for people to get organized. Super PACs didn't happen overnight, but they sure began to happen. I talked to Senator McConnell once, and I said, well, Senator, do you think any statewide race in the future can be run without super PACs? He said, no. He said, with the money that it takes to run a U.S. Senate race, they are now part of the system. So I think the system will change. There will be more money. Political parties may be strengthened. That's one of the
positive
benefits.
I was going to bring
benefits.
That up, yeah.
And
yeah.
That is not a bad thing. I think, in some respects, a stronger political party system. Now, it may make a bigger fight over control of that party all of a sudden, even from the establishment and the Tea Party types and the Republican side or in the Democratic Party, which is basically a subsidiary of the unions at this point in Michigan. It may change and be a broader-based party. So arguably things will change. They will not be the same. Every election cycle is different. The weapons people use, the sophistication of technology, television ads are kind of going away, and other kinds of media. So the campaigns are different, and this law or this McCutcheon decision will affect us in ways that we don't really know. One of the wealthy people I talked to, and I'll stop here, was very concerned. He says, unfortunately, I'm the kind of guy who can give the money, this is his assistant, to a lot of people. I used to be able to say no. When we got to 100 and some thousand, I could say no.
They lost
now
their
they know.
Out.
Now they know I don't have that argument. That is a problem for some of these very wealthy people that get hit up by everybody. And it happens. It's one of the best practical arguments. I happen to disagree with it constitutionally. But limits are good because politicians, there is no limit to what they can ask for. They will ask for if they can.
Rich Robinson, is that a silver lining in this for you? That it seems a lot of folks are seeing that the political parties might wrest a little bit more control back from these super PACs where they don't have as much control or any control over what's going on.
Well, the fact that there are no limits whatever on giving to the nonprofits, there's the benefit of anonymity. Yes, maybe on the margins the parties will have a little bit more money, but they have been eclipsed by the other groups. But let me give you a hypothetical example of what could happen, what's potentially at stake here with a joint fundraising committee. In this state, the DeVos family gives money to politics like no one else. If you took the adult members of the nuclear DeVos family, say Justin Amash set up a joint fundraising committee for candidates, party, and PACs, those nine family members could give $40 million instantly, $57 million in the course of a two-year election cycle, and Justin Amash could go into the caucus room with $90,000 for every member of his caucus, $45,000 of which would be for the leadership PACs. Now, he could say, my donor friends don't want anything. But you know what they like and what they don't like.
And that's the situation where we're in with these joint fundraising committees who might be left with the ability to move money around. Maybe they might be used a little bit more with this new
restriction. Yeah, I would argue if you can use a joint fundraising, you'll do it. I mean, we created 20 years ago because of limits. We helped create the Michigan Senatorial Trust, which was a series of committees. The utilities had a ballot, a $40,000 limit on of ballot campaigns, and they created 1,000 different committees. So whatever, if you create these limits, people will find a way around them, and these kinds of, you take the numbers and then push them to the extreme and then pick somebody like the Koch brothers or in Michigan, the DeVos interests, and you can come up with some scary pictures. The DeVos people give a lot of money, and they will continue to give.
Well, gentlemen, it's been a robust conversation. Thank you. I appreciate you taking the time. We could probably blow out the rest of the hour, but we'll leave it there. We'll leave it there. Rich Robinson is the executive director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, and Richard McClellan is a longtime Lansing attorney and GOP power broker. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
The sun may be shining and the snow may be melting, but the effects of this year's harsh winter are still lingering. The ice and cold damaged some of Michigan's fruit trees. Current State's Emmanuel Berry spoke with Mark Longstroth, no relation to me, Lindstroth, the extension, a small fruit educator. Emmanuel, how might Michigan's fruit crop shape up this spring?
Well, in part, it kind of depends on the winter. If, God forbid, it gets cold and we have another frost, things might not go so well. But regardless of that, the impact of winter will be felt. Mark Longstroth said that peaches and wine grapes might be damaged because of the cold temps. They're the most vulnerable fruits, and they can suffer severe damage when temperatures reach 15 degrees below zero.
We got down to, minus 13, minus 17, and into the minus 20s across large areas of the state and the southern tier of counties. Many of the peaches are grown close to Lake Michigan, and a lot are grown in Berrien County. And so we're telling people that we think there's about a 50% reduction in the peaches. Now, That means that some guys have been wiped out and other guys haven't suffered much damage. And with peaches, you have a lot of flowers on the tree, but you don't need all those flowers to be a peach because they would normally thin 80 to 90% of them off and to get large peaches for sale. So it's kind of hard to say. We can say that, you know, peaches were hurt and wine grapes were hurt by the cold, but we really don't have a real good idea of how bad the damage is until they start to grow some more and we can see how they respond.
What about cherries and apples? Do they survive the cold better or have a higher tolerance for colder temperatures?
Oh, apples have the highest tolerance for cold temperatures. We generally don't worry about the flower buds of apples until we get down into the minus 20s, minus 25 or colder. We may see some apples show some damage, but I don't expect widespread damage. And apples are an awful lot like peaches. They have many more flowers than you need for a full crop. With an awful lot of the fruit crops, we had a very heavy crop last year, and that kind of stressed the plants and made them perhaps less winter hardy. But it also reduced the fruitfulness for this coming year. So we're going to have, last year we had like 2 years worth of crop of apples and grapes, and this year we'll have a more normal, perhaps less than average crop. With cherries, it's a little harder to tell. We had a really nice winter for just being able to withstand the cold, because when it got cold, it stayed cold, and it didn't warm up and get warm and then get cold again. It just stayed cold for the whole time, so we were really well set up to withstand those cold temperatures. And so cherries are a little bit harder. We're seeing some damage in sweet cherries, and we're seeing a little bit of damage in tarts where we've been out looking. So it's kind of hard to tell, because cherries are often hurt by spring freezes, and the fact that our spring is starting so late reduces the chance that we're going to have a spring frost, because the plants will be growing more slowly, and when it warms up and it gets a freeze, they won't be as far advanced and won't be as susceptible to temperatures just below freezing because they haven't reached that stage of development yet.
So it's almost kind of been a plus that there's been such thick ice coverage near the lake, near Traverse City, because it hasn't thawed, so we haven't had
But the bad part of having ice on that lake on Traverse Bay and in Lake Michigan was, while Lake Michigan protected us at the beginning of the season, the coldest temperatures we saw in southwest Michigan were the first week of January. The West Coast skipped an awful lot of that until we got the cold temperatures at the end of February and March, when Lake Michigan was almost frozen over, and so the lake didn't help us as much then. That's when they saw the coldest temperatures up north, was pretty late in the season, about 3-4 weeks ago.
Now, as you said, we're entering a late thaw this year, but still how this year's crop turns out will in part be determined by how spring ends up shaping up. So I guess first, what's the best case scenario for weather this spring in relation to fruit crops?
Well, the best case scenario would be that it gets warm and stays warm. The other more likely scenario is that we will have a cool spring and might be a week or two late when we harvest at the other end. But because we were late, we didn't get any freezes, and so that those people who suffered freeze damage in the winter don't suffer a frost. It's not unusual for cherries, when they start to come out, to get a freeze, and that freeze might kill 90% of the cherries in an area. And we haven't seen anywhere near that amount of winter damage. We're looking at maybe 25-30% at the most in the tart cherries I've looked at. And so if we don't get a freeze, we'll probably have a fairly decent cherry crop and peach crop, and the apple growers will be worrying about how they can thin off their excess crop.
So potentially a good year for growing.
Well, because last year was such a really good year, we had such a heavy crop, we don't anticipate a year like last year, but we'd be pretty happy with an average year.
Not only was this winter cold, but there was also a lot of heavy snowfall. What are some of the pros and cons of that heavy snowfall in relation to growing?
Snow is very helpful for somebody who's like a strawberry grower. where the snow protects, acts as the insulating blanket. And even though it got very, very cold, down here we had 2 feet of snow on the ground for most of the winter. And it just, you know, melted off just recently. So the snow provides an insulating blanket. And in the winter of 94, we got down into the mid-minus 20s and saw extensive damage in peaches and cherries and grapes down here. And they were killed to the snow line. And so many of the grapes came back from that portion of the trunk that was covered by snow. For most of the others, the most sensitive part of the fruit tree is the graft, that area between the rootstock, a variety that we selected to control the size or the nutrition of the top, and then what we call the scion, that's the top part of the tree, which is a cutting that we took, say, like for Red Delicious. From the original Red Delicious tree, every Red Delicious that's grown now is a cutting off that original tree. Or for Honeycrisp, an apple that's very, very popular, every Honeycrisp tree is actually a cutting that's been grafted on a rootstock and is a clone of the original Honeycrisp tree that was bred in Minnesota.
A lot of people would say that this winter was extreme. Is this something that farmers are having to deal with more and more often?
Well, certainly not extreme of this nature. I had a lot of people tell me that this was, you know, the type of winter they remembered from their childhood in Michigan with lots of snow, though many admitted that they don't remember it being as cold for as long as it was cold. They remembered it being cold and getting warm and being cold and getting warm. We're more worried about extremes like we had 2 years ago when we started warming up very, very quickly, and by the middle of March we were where we should have been at the end of April, and then we started to get the normal freezes that we would have gotten in April and suffered severe damage there. So that's one thing. Some fruit growers have the ability to buy crop insurance, and so the government subsidizes their insurance premium. They couldn't afford to pay the premium by themselves if they had to cover the risk of the crop, but the government pays part of the premium, and the grower pays part of the premium. And so if they lose their crop to frost, they will get reimbursed for the level of insurance that they bought. And so like the minimum amount of insurance they could get is 50%. So if they lost 60% of their crop, they get reimbursed for the 10% that they lost if they took care of everything. Or if they lost 100%, they get reimbursed for 50% of the crop, and they can often buy up to 60, 70, 80% coverage if they want to pay more on a premium, because the government only covers their base. We anticipate that if the climate gets warmer, you know, that we will have a longer growing season with the spring starting earlier and the growing season going longer into the summer, so we might be able to grow more varieties that are better suited for areas to the south of us, but there's really no preparing for something that's a bolt out of the blue like this winter was. We felt pretty good coming into the year because we'd already seen a couple of temperatures below zero, but we didn't realize that we were going to go down close to 20 about four times.
What does this look like regionally? Are we seeing similar issues in states to the south of us?
The cold weather conditions that hit us also hit areas to the south. Indiana and Ohio and Illinois, Pennsylvania and New York. So this is a pretty widespread phenomenon. And even though many growers may have a reduced crop, because we have a short crop here in the eastern United States, there's a possibility that they'll have a pretty good market with a good price for their fruit.
Mark Longstroth is a small fruit educator for MSU's Extension Program. Mark, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Emmanuel.
This segment is supported in part by the Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. For more news on the Great Lakes Basin, you can check out greatlakesecho.org.
And you're listening to Current State on WKAR. I'm Joe Lindstroth, in for Mark Bayshore. Michigan has long been proud of its diverse agricultural profile. Many growers are active in the buy local movement through farmers markets and food hubs. Now, Michigan State University and the Ann Arbor-based Ecology Center are launching the Michigan Food to Institution Network. Current State's Kevin Lavery is here to tell us more.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Well, hello, Kevin.
Hi, nice to be here. Yes, the founders of what's now called the Food to Institution Network are trying to get more locally sourced food into the cafeterias of large entities like school districts and hospitals and universities. Their goal is to have 20% of the food products come from Michigan growers by the year 2020. I spoke with Colleen Matz about this. She is with MSU's Center for Regional Food Systems. She feels the Farm to Institution Network can be a real engine that will help drive the buy local movement.
So with institutions already interested in purchasing local food, the demand is there, and that can really drive our growers to maybe produce more local food to go into local markets. It can help those food hubs and food innovation districts have the business they need to really move food, aggregate food, process food, to get it to those institutions that already want it.
How much Michigan-grown food do these large entities like school districts and hospitals use? Is a lot of it contracted from out of state?
Well, with contracted food service, we're seeing that there's a lot more work that can be done. There is support for more local food coming in, especially from the food service staff on the ground in those institutions. But within their corporate structures, some of the vendors and their procurement contracts may limit how much those food service directors can purchase local. So what we're hoping to do through this network in the long term is to really bring a collective voice to those contracted food service operations and send that message up to their corporate powers that be to let them know that on the ground people want this, and together we can have a stronger voice than any one of them alone to really make for the change that we're hoping to see, to get more local food into those systems and really help our farmers and our agricultural economy.
Aside from the revenue aspects of this and the idea of keeping local dollars local, what are some of the nutritional arguments involved with buying local? Certainly, school districts across the country have put up a hue and cry over we need healthier alternatives in terms of food for our children.
Well, the USDA issued new nutrition standards for school meals recently, as most people know, and there was a little bit of a backlash to those standards when they came into play. But Farm to School can really help support those standards by providing the diversity of products, the colors of vegetables that they're looking for in school meals now, the oranges, the greens, all of those things are locally available. And of course, that's in season. So Farm to School can help support kids' increased access to those fresh, healthy, local foods, and that can be across the board for institutions anywhere. So we look at this as a way to increase eaters' access to local foods through institutions which supply so many meals to Michiganders.
Recently, you had a kickoff event to get this program up and going. Who came? Who expressed interest? Who were you trying to reach for this kickoff? And how will you cultivate those relationships going forward now?
So at the network, we had over 120 people register and attend. That ranges from food service directors from all types of institutions, hospitals, colleges, K-12 schools, even early care programs and long-term care programs. So we have great representation on the institutional side. We have farmers, we have food distributors, both large and small. We have food processors here. Some food hubs are here. Food systems advocates and others who are in support of increasing residents' access to local food are here. So it's a really great representation of what it takes to make farm to institution work at the local level and what it will take us to make big change at the state or even the regional level.
What are some of your next steps along the way toward creating all this?
Well, we have a few things that we have in the works. Right now, our website, cultivatemichigan.org, is really geared towards institutions. We're asking them to sign up, create a profile, get in on that dashboard, and start collecting data so that we can see across the state how much food our institutions are purchasing already, but how much local they begin to purchase and how that ramps up over time. We also want to develop more of a farmer engagement strategy, so we know that we need the farmers there with the supply at the same time as our demand might be increasing. So we're working on developing a plan for farmers to engage in our website in a similar way. And we're hoping to develop a partnership strategy and kind of formalize partnerships with some organizational partners that can support this work as well. And then we have some really basic how-tos that we need to develop to make it easier for our institutions to do this on their own. We're certainly here to support and share the stories and lift up the champions, but we want to make it as easy as possible for institutions to get started.
A year from now, Colleen, when you look back on the origins of this, how will you be able to gauge how successful this is? And do you have a target as to a percentage of our population you'd like to reach with better access to local food, particularly people who live below the poverty level?
Well, in the first year, I would like to see about 100 institutions sign up on our website. And I think that is doable, but I think it's also an ambitious goal. So I hope we can get there. In Michigan, there are so many institutions that serve lower income residents, especially with our schools and those kids that rely on free and reduced price meals. So it's not hard for us to reach the people that really need better access to local food once we get to those institutions. So institutions are a really powerful way to share the wealth, essentially, and increase access to local foods.
Colleen Matz is with Michigan State University's Center for Regional Food Systems and a co-coordinator of the new Michigan Farm to Institution Network. Colleen, thank you, and best of luck on this.
Thanks, we really appreciate it, and thanks for sharing the story.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Current State on WKAR. It took some time for America to emerge from the Great Recession, sparked in 2008 by the collapse of the housing bubble. The economy is generally improving, but we continue to see a growing disparity between the wealthy and the poor. This week, the Peace Education Center of Greater Lansing is sponsoring a community conversation on the income disparity in America. And joining me now to talk about the event is Terry Link, who serves on the Peace Education Center board. Welcome to Current State, Terry.
Hi, Joe. Nice to talk to you.
And nice to speak with you. So what do we know about this income gap in America? I think it's kind of all over the news. It's getting wider. Is that right?
Well, most of the evidence indicates that it is indeed getting wider. And so we believe that we need to have frank, open conversations about the kinds of issues like this that separate us.
Now, this event employs a process for creating dialogue about wealth and poverty that was created by the National Dialogue Network. There's a series of questions and a packet meant to spark discussion. Tell me more about the format. What will you be doing?
Okay, so the emphasis in this particular format is really about engaging people in an approach where you're really doing a lot of listening to people like yourself, but hopefully a diverse set of folks with different views. And so there are three kind of phases that the discussion will go through around three, maybe you could think of them as sub-areas of poverty and wealth. And people, you know, explore how they think and feel about this and why they do it in a somewhat controlled atmosphere where, again, the emphasis is on open-mindedness and curiosity and discovering things and speaking honestly and feeling that it would be a safe place to do that with the idea being that coming out of it, people will have a deeper appreciation for how others think and feel about the issues of poverty and maybe then reflect on their own in relationship to that.
Do wealth and poverty necessarily have to be measured in terms of physical assets like money? Is that something you'll be looking at in terms of defining what wealth actually is in poverty?
Each table will kind of take their own track. We ran this last week here on campus, and that came up at two tables. That, you know, how we do, what is wealth and what is prosperity, and do we have to measure them economically? And I think there's a great divergence of ideas on that.
And so, what happens at the end of the event? You know, all these folks have got together. I imagine shared some honest opinions. Probably a bit of disagreement in the room. What's going to happen when the data is collected and aggregated? What will you do with it?
Well, essentially, we're going to send in, there's some survey stuff that people do at the end, and then we will send that in to the National Dialogue Network, and people can see both how, as a group, this particular set of people at this particular time down at LCC tomorrow night think about it, but also in relation to other sites across the country, how people have thought about the issues and the process, because the process is just as important, if not more important, than the actual content itself. And that's this whole aspect of Let's Talk is really about giving people different kinds of experiences to talk about complex, deeply felt issues and how we can move forward with that.
I was just going to say, so just so I understand, it's more about creating a space to have a dialogue than it is to create policy or policy recommendations.
Right, but it could be that other folks will want to do something with this, and some of the sponsors that are there, like the Michigan League for Public Policy, Capital Area District Libraries, Power of We Consortium, League of Women Voters, Common Cause, may have materials there, and people can pick up and maybe connect one of those or some other entities in the area that's working on these issues in one way or another. So that we're not going into action-oriented stuff, but the emphasis here really is on really changing the way we talk.
Now, you had an event you mentioned last Friday at MSU. What was the feedback that you got on that?
People enjoyed the process in terms of it allowed them to listen to other people in a different way. They wanted more social time at the end to really get to know each other and understand a little bit more than they could. I mean, but this is done in small groups, probably no more than six people at a table. So there more cross-pollination would have been interesting, but they liked where the conversation took them.
So real quick, Terry, when and where can folks join you in the second dialogue event?
Okay, it's tomorrow night, the 9th, down at LCC in the Administration Building Boardroom. It's 7 o'clock. We'll be out of there by 9. And we'll be refreshments.
Great. Thanks, Terry. Terry Link is the board member on the Peace Education Center here in Greater Lansing.
Thank you, Joe.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, our Neighbors in Action segment features the Youth Action Council. Also, we'll speak with Capital City Film Festival organizers about this year's offerings. That and more tomorrow on Current State. I'm Joe Lindstroth, in for Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR 90.5 FM. Have a great day.